We were a relatively normal, conservative, religious family. There were always things that stood out. The house we lived in after 1982 had odd features that made little sense. In the basement of the house, there was a spare bedroom with an attached bathroom. This was weird for a house that was built in 1905. Back then, basements were just basements. They were not often made into livable space. The bedroom was used by my oldest brother in the late 1980s. Before that, it was used as an office by my dad. On the stairway leading down into the basement, there was a landing. On the wall at this landing, there was a removable shadow board panel that would allow a person to see into the bathroom. The large mirror on the basement bathroom wall was a two-way mirror. From the landing in the basement, one could see the entire bathroom. They would also be able to see a large portion of the bedroom if the bathroom door was open. This means that before we purchased the house, someone had been using the feature to spy on people in the bedroom-bathroom combo in the basement. I suspect that the feature was likely installed for voyeuristic purposes by the previous owner. Even though this feature existed at the house before we moved in, it stands out as just another oddity of my childhood. As I mentioned previously, that basement room functioned as my father's office for quite some time. On numerous occasions, I spotted him removing the panel to investigate the basement bathroom and bedroom. He did this at a time when nobody would have been living down there. My question was always the same. What was he expecting to see in an empty room? We were a working, poor family. But in 1985, my father purchased a video camera that in those days would have cost well over $1,000. The camera was set up in his basement office on a tripod that pointed into a television screen. I would eventually find that he was recording videos of the television screen while the camera was using the same television screen as an output. This created an infinite loop, like having two mirrors facing each other, and was a form of electronic divination that he learned about. By using the camera in this manner, an electronic doorway would be created, allowing one to record strange, nebulous images. Others that used this technique claimed to have filmed dead loved ones, demons, and many other inexplicable images. I saw this on a TV show many years later and was mystified as to how he had heard about this. This was very difficult for me to understand given that he was an old school Christian that would have viewed such practices as satanic. It's fair to say that for a time, he became obsessed with making these videos and interpreting them by watching them in frame-by-frame slow motion. These videos had strange sounds and images that I would venture to say were representative of pareidolia. I believe that he was doing this in the midst of a spiritual crisis. He was possibly plagued by something he didn't understand. This was likely the same process I was going through while writing Luminosity. He would certainly have been around the same age. I think that he was attempting to find evidence of something and keep his work secret from everyone. His video camera would be a staple of my childhood. Everything we did was recorded. He'd taken to filming us at family dinners, holidays, and other events. Extended family members would often yell at him to stop filming all the time. To this day, I have a large library of digital copied home movies that span most of my childhood and teenage years. These videos even include the birth of my oldest children. Before he purchased the infamous video camera, he would audio record us at various times. He would ask us questions and have us answer into a microphone. The questions were mostly innocent and had to do with our thoughts on simple things like favourite foods and things we were learning about in school. On the surface, it all seemed very innocuous, but deep down, I felt that he was aware of something more. He was doing surveillance, and he didn't want to frighten anyone. This can only mean that over the years, he also had been aware that something was happening in the house. I can say this because many of the audio recordings have no purpose at all. They are simply left to record while everyone can be heard speaking in the distance in an entirely different room. Was he hoping to capture something strange? Despite him no longer being the hardline evangelist, but a typical 80-year-old great-grandpa, he still does not wish to discuss these years, but admits that strange things were taking place. I think that whatever was happening made him feel powerless, and as a man with a family, there was no option to be powerless. Quite some years ago, my dad gave me an old Bible. Inside that Bible was a sheet of paper that was printed on both sides and titled Demons in the Bible. The sheet had been typewritten with great care. It contained a list of nearly every Bible verse that was related to demonic activity. By deduction, I figured that it had been written between 1982 and 87 in the very basement office where my dad spent his time on that typewriter. I believe even now that he knew something was happening. His only frame of reference to define it was through his Christian faith. In the end, I think his faith ultimately failed in making sense of what was happening. In the mid-1980s, my experiences became more frightening. In our neighbourhood, there was an ongoing rumour among the children that a strange family lived nearby. Nobody could quite say what house they lived in, but the consensus was that they lived in a rickety house on the corner of 28th and Cleveland Avenue. That house was demolished years ago to make room for an industrial building. It was the most agreed-upon location of where they lived. Numerous people said they frequently saw the family's vehicle parked there. The rumour was that this family would drive around looking for young boys to kidnap and molest. Frankly, the very thought of this terrified me and other kids a great deal. Around this time, I would help an elderly neighbour named Florence take out her garbage and stop at the corner shop to pick up her groceries. She usually paid me in quarters, and despite the hassle she always put me through, I was always willing to help her out. One afternoon, after taking out her trash, she'd given me a stern warning to stay away from a particular truck that had been driving down our street more frequently. The truck had been painted in an animal print. It stuck out like a sore thumb and would always give me the creeps. Florence proceeded to tell me that the previous night she had seen the occupants of that truck looking in the windows of her next-door neighbour's house. She told me that they were interested in the little boy Christopher that lived there and would slow down and stare at him whenever they came down our street. She even used the word molest in her warning, which chilled my blood. I assured her that I would stay away from them and ran home. The entire exchange with Florence terrified me. I felt I no longer wanted to go outside. The rumours of this strange family went on and evolved into a typical urban legend. As the story goes, another boy that I knew named Bruce had been taken by them and dropped off hours later while walking along Forest Home Avenue. Everyone claimed he was never the same after that. As always, the rumours became more fanciful. Soon, they were killing children in the night, and the factories at the end of the block were a human slaughter operation. One day, my friends and I had been playing baseball in the alley behind 28th and Arthur Street in Milwaukee, and we saw the truck driving by, slowly, on 27th Street. They were watching us, as we could see the shadow of their heads looking towards us. We ran and hid. It was a terrible feeling to be stalked, and left me wondering if some monster was going to kidnap us. Real or imagined, I was scared. This felt so much more than a mere urban legend. The family would eventually come to be called the Inbreeds. Those that saw them up close said they didn't look quite right, yet nobody ever knew how many were in the family. Even now, I remember hanging out with groups of friends in the alley and discussing the Inbreeds, and how Bruce had now become terrified of his own shadow. While sitting together in the alley at night, someone would say, "What would you do if they started driving down this alley right now?" When someone would yell, "There they are!" in jest, I would feel a subtle paralysis of fear grip me instantly. Unlike most of those kids who told the more fanciful, I would end up being one of the people that actually saw them up close and personal. Looking back on that day over 30 years ago, I still remember the fear it evoked. I remember the abstract yet very real people I saw in the truck that day. One day, in the winter of 1986, there was a terrible accident on nearby 27th Street, which was a busy thoroughfare. The traffic was being rerouted down the street I lived on. I remember that it was winter and I was playing on snowdrifts alongside the street when I saw the animal-patterned truck in the distance. For reasons I do not know, I decided to wait and see the occupants of the truck for myself. I was relatively close to my house and likely felt that if I had to run, I could make it to my house. I felt frozen by fear and anticipation, but even if I wanted to run away, I would not have been able to. I was stuck like a magnet, and that truck was getting closer. I could feel my heart pounding out of my chest. Would I be taken? Would I see something that I did not want to see? I remembered Florence's warning to keep away, but I simply couldn't move. The only positive thing I remembered thinking was that it was still a bit light outside. Somehow, I felt that this would thwart them from trying to take me. As they got closer, I was able to make out distinct shapes through the windshield. There were three or maybe four of them inside. Their eyes were fixated upon me and nothing else. I could see their eyes and was awash in fear. Standing upon the snowdrift, I was at a slightly higher elevation than they were. I was looking down at them slightly. As we crossed paths, my mind began to race. I struggled to hold what I was seeing. Their faces clearly weren't right. One of them seemed to be missing its lower jaw completely. I could only make out its upper teeth and huge eyes. Everything I saw in that truck could be surmised as eyeballs and abstract human-like shapes. It was terrifying. My mind could not make out or put together what I was looking at. The eyeballs were fixated on me, but no matter how hard I tried, I could not piece any shape inside the truck into a coherent human form. Only eyeballs, noses, teeth, and stringy hair in a chaotic mix. As the truck passed and our gazes broke, the fear paralysis let up and I ran inside the house. I would tell this story to friends, which simply enforced the ever-continuing saga of the inbreeds. Even years after this event, including once as an older teenager, I would see that truck roaming along on the south side of Milwaukee from time to time. As I got older, the fear of it faded away, but the strange feeling it gave me remains. I've noticed a recurring phenomenon of events like this. My memories of these encounters always feel tampered with. I am left wondering if what I saw was flavoured by fear, or if my memory is true, and the images I saw in the cab of that truck represented something truly horrifying and dangerous. During this same period, other things were happening as well. Our family owned a cottage in the North Woods near Eagle River, Wisconsin. The cottage was quite isolated and sat on 33 acres of land directly on Black Oak Lake. It was like paradise going there as a child. I was free to roam the property, shoot guns, start large controlled fires, fish, and sit out under the stars late into the evening. We always went up in late August when vacationers were largely headed home. This let us have the lake mostly to ourselves for fishing and boating. In the evenings, we would go into town for ice cream. The roads to and from the cottage were mostly gravel and there were no street lights, so walking out there without a flashlight at night was impossible. My dad would often drive fast down these gravel roads and turn off the headlights to scare us. He knew the roads so well that he felt it would be a relatively safe way to scare us. The feeling of moving very quickly while being unable to see your hand in front of your face was terrifying. One evening, while driving on the roads and turning off the headlights, my mum noticed movement ahead of us. When my dad turned the lights on, he illuminated a strange-looking man pushing a stroller down the gravel road. Everybody in the car became dead silent with fear. It was as if there was a silent gasp. I had been out on those roads at night with a flashlight and knew there was no way anyone could walk without a light. Being as isolated as we were, to see anybody that late in the evening was very odd. That this person was pushing a stroller and didn't have a flashlight terrified everyone. The rest of the drive was quiet. I remember wanting to pack up and go home that same night. I was terrified of this man walking toward our cottage or staring in the windows while we slept. The thought of that haunted me to no end. As usual, I could not make out the face as we passed him. It seemed obscured. It was hidden behind the ambiguity typical of these type of events. Luckily, we had never laid eyes on this man and his stroller again. Throughout the latter part of the 80s, I began to suffer from a terrible fear that I was going to be kidnapped. I remember walking to school and constantly looking over my shoulder. I had a recurring dream that I was taken by a man in a white Volkswagen Beetle who would keep me in a large wooden box with two eye holes cut into it. Deep down, I knew that I was going to be trapped in that box forever. Such nightmares were common. My mind was preoccupied with dark thoughts that I could not escape. It was as if an unseen presence was always nearby, presenting itself to me through diverse manifestations of thought and phantom phenomena, like the Harlequin. Around this same time, I became convinced that there was a secret room in our house that could be accessed through a small wine cellar in the basement. There was a space behind that wall that seemed to be the size of a large walk-in closet. I told my cousin this belief. She thought I was crazy. After moving several large carboys from the corner of the cellar, there was a hole in the wall at about knee level. I crouched down and looked in, and to my amazement began seeing shapes. The objects seemed to be made of static. There was no colour, just black and white, as if one was looking into a dimly lit room. Soon, the shapes began to come together into a tangible form. Through the hole, I saw a figure sitting on a chair. The closer I looked, the more the sight forming in front of me seemed cartoonish. The shape was Muppet-like in appearance, staring back at me. It looked similar to Oscar the Grouch, but with a far meaner and more ominous look to it. The manner in which it stared back at me communicated that it wanted to harm me. I began to feel threatened as its face looked angered and ready to bite. I instantly felt an explosion go off in my head, which caused me to jump back and run out of the cellar with my cousin. I was fighting back tears. I did not want to tell my parents about this because I knew how they would respond, with anger and disbelief. The experience itself was reminiscent of a fever dream a child might have, just like the two-way mirror set up at the landing of the basement stairs. I believe there was indeed a space behind the wall in the cellar. If I were to guess, it was a false wall the previous owner installed. Thinking about this now, I wonder if the previous owners were running some kind of illegal operation out of the house that required these features to be installed. The previous owners of the house made updates that were suspicious. I was with my parents at the closing on that house. I remember the previous owners being with us in an office. It was a husband and wife. Did they disclose these strange features of the house? My dad seemed to be aware of them early on. Anecdotal experiences like sinister Muppets hiding in secret rooms became normal happenings to me. So many of these memories have a nightmarish quality. I often questioned whether I was losing my mind. I concluded early on that things were not what they appeared to be. There was far more complexity to these encounters than the simple answer of mental illness or an overactive imagination. Even though I'd partially dismissed the Harlequin visitations as childhood imagination as I got older, the more peculiar memories and inner states never left me. The early visitations always remained as the source point of every other odd event that occurred. I saw all of them as related, a meta-phenomenon that stretched through the years. The Harlequin seemed to be the personification of all of it, the image from which all other events I was exposed to emerged. One thing was certain. The anomalous experiences I was having were constantly changing. They were always developing and evolving as I grew and matured. They often came forth as custom-made for maximum shock value to my soul. I came to believe that whatever was causing them knew my deepest, darkest fears and was able to exploit them at will by presenting them to my conscious mind. The question I could not answer was if the experiences were meant to somehow help me in an indirect way or harm me. I simply didn't know. It wasn't until I became an adult that I began to realize that whatever was causing these things to happen belonged to a reality that was in some way attached to my sleeping, unconscious mind and my genetic history. As the phenomenon developed, it seemed to follow my interests and my understanding of the world. It interjected itself wherever and whenever it could. I would learn that the more attention I gave it, the stronger it would become. From 1989 to 1993, the strange experiences began to taper off to some extent. The experiences I did have always revolved around seeing UFOs and the feelings and states they induced in me. These experiences included very brief memories, literally fractions of a second, of lights coming in through my bedroom windows and paralysis. Looking back at those years, it seems obvious why very few events manifested. Since I was going through puberty and constantly changing in both body and mind, the strangeness, potentially, had no clear way to manifest itself. I was too preoccupied with other things to focus on things that went deep. Therefore, the strangeness remained in the shadows for years, waiting for an opportunity to reveal itself again. This all changed in the summer of 1993. I had fallen asleep in my room while listening to headphones one night. I was listening to a cassette shortly before I drifted off to sleep. Out of the silence, I was awakened by what sounded like an emergency news report coming through the headphones. The problem is that my stereo had been set to cassette, making it impossible for the radio stations to suddenly activate without slipping a switch and turning to an actual radio station. The voice coming out of my headphones sounded like a reporter claiming that he was trapped in a cave and dying. He would speak about his hatred for life now that he was trapped inside the bowels of the earth. He would utter strange sentences like, "The near-death experiences have started now," and "Have a little death, dirt," while explaining his disgust about how the earth always creates violent storms and earthquakes that often kill many people. These statements became increasingly more sinister and frightening. I was fully alert once it began. My eyes were open and I became so panic-stricken that I could not move. I was convinced that I was losing my mind. It was the middle of the night and everyone was sleeping. My thoughts began to race and became so alien to who I was that I felt they were no longer my own. Something had managed to invade my mind space. Whatever it was, didn't care that it was evoking a paralyzing terror in me. For all intents and purposes, it was my fear that allowed it to grow much stronger and to become more real. Soon, the reporter on the radio would say, "We are getting closer now. We are coming through the walls." As it said that, its voice echoed and reverberated out of the headphones and into the room. At least that's what it sounded like to me. As abruptly as the voices began, they stopped. The room suddenly became silent in an instant, as though nothing had ever happened. I was horrified beyond measure. I could not be convinced that what I had experienced was just a dream. It was far too real. The quiet stillness that followed was nearly as bad as listening to the voices coming out of the radio. I laid there in expectation of even worse events to come. The phenomena found a new entry point through my fear. At that time, I was too young to understand what was happening. I certainly didn't know where to look for answers, One was limited to the local library for resources to research these things. It was a slow process. There was no way to get in contact or even find the experts who deal with anomalous experiences. What I experienced that night was so outside the normal wavelength of human experience that I wouldn't have been happy with any explanation I was given, including the main one I would have heard from my family, demonic influence. I decided my best option was to remain quiet and hope that it wouldn't begin to happen regularly. I remember at that time thinking that whatever was happening could potentially escalate. I became more occupied by the idea of UFOs and men in black at this time because it was the only thing that seemed to define what I'd experienced. With a healthy dose of the TV show Unsolved Mysteries, my mind began to explore more possibilities. The voice coming through the radio that night was not exactly human. It was too perfect, almost like it belonged to a robotic entity that had mastered the English language. It had no accent or impediment of any kind. It was loud, potent, and spoke matter-of-factly. It sounded more like the caricature of a news reporter than an actual news reporter, and that's what scared me the most. The mental image my mind conjured during this event was a man that looked like Bob Dobbs, the mascot and prophet of the Church of the Subgenius. The non-humanness of the encounter and the associated emotive power that was released inside my head made memories of this event linger in my thoughts. After the radio experience, things remained quiet again for a time. There was no escalation of strange experiences, just life as usual. All of this would change in June of 1994, on the weekend of my high school graduation, when I would have my first, most direct experience in normal waking consciousness of the Harlequin as a young man. It began just a few minutes after I left a graduation party with some friends. I don't remember what time it was exactly, but it was very late and there were very few cars on the road. We were headed north on 76th Street, and we stopped at the traffic light on 76th and Oklahoma Avenue on the southwest side of Milwaukee. When the light turned green, we noticed what appeared to be a young woman with blonde hair walking on the east side of the street. She had come out from behind a video store on the corner. As she walked, we noticed that her movements were very jerky. In those days, there was a small park on the northwest corner of that intersection, where a few unsavory types used to loiter day and night. It wasn't unusual to see homeless people or drug users in that general area during the summer months. My initial thought was she was possibly a part of that group of people. One of the individuals in my car that evening thought he knew who she was. Even at that moment, the idea that she had a normal name and identity seemed ridiculous to me. Something didn't feel right. As we got closer to her, we began to slow down to get a better look. She took immediate notice of us. Her movements became more exaggerated and violent, like a character in a zombie film. With every step she took, her hair bounced more violently, tipping us off that she was wearing a cheap wig that at any moment could have fallen off her head, revealing something truly horrifying. We soon realized that nobody in the car knew who this person was. Once again, my blood went cold with fear. The feeling of unnerving eeriness fell over us, and every moment felt like slow-motion dread as we came closer to seeing her face. Everyone was in this quiet state of disbelief because the moment did not jibe with normal human experience. What we witnessed didn't look or act like a person. It acted like someone pretending to be a normal person. As we crossed paths, she began to walk directly toward my car, as if she had a mission. From only a few feet away, I saw her clearly through the passenger window. There was no mistaking the round mouth and intensity in the large eyes. The Harlequin was wearing a wig and pretending to be a normal person, walking down the street. From the back seat, someone said, "Oh my God, her eyes!" A panic struck everyone. I was told to floor it, which I did without hesitation. We flew down 76th Street until we were far enough away to feel somewhat safe. We didn't want her to somehow catch up with us again. That seemed to be an irrational thought, since she was on foot and we were in a car. Immediately after we passed her, someone said that she had yelled something at us. I agreed. There was a very brief explosion of some type of information. The sense that we had just been warned to back away seemed clear to us. The only issue I have with being verbally warned by the Harlequin is that I understand we weren't actually yelled at. I believe that everyone had received an intuitive gestalt to promptly leave now that we had seen what we did. Even though we'd put some miles between us and her, each person struggled to get out of the car that night, out of fear that this strange woman might somehow have caught back up to us. Again, that is not a rational fear. It stems from being in the presence of something that transcends mundane experiences of fear. It was primal. Someone said they believed that she was a dead person. I found that to be an apt description of what we saw. She personified death, and the fear of death. I am still plagued by the thought of what could have happened if I was on foot that night, or if I had stopped the car completely and allowed her to come closer.